Thank you for joining us. The following program is presented by Rico Cortez.
Shalom, we're continuing our teaching on the temple service and his daily service. Now we're going to talk about the breastplate, the choshen, the breastplate of the high priest. And it basically begins with 12 stones. So you can see on the screen, the 12 stones are made up of 12 precious stones that the inside each stone has the name of the children of Israel. Very significant because there's not a stone for Gentiles. Gentiles have to become grafted into Israel so they can partake of the blessings and they can partake of being part of the 12 tribes. Otherwise, there's no kingdom for you. There's no redemption. There's no. The Bible is very clear. The house of Israel and the house of Judah. He made a covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah in Jeremiah 31:31. Hebrews chapter 8, verse 8, 9, 10, 11. Okay? Talks about that. Now, the breastplate of judgment, that's really what the high priest is all about. He says, it had 12 precious stones in it. One, I'm not going to give you the order because nobody knows exactly which order the breastplate of the high priest basically is located now, okay? But we have the ruby or emerald, Reuben, red, color's red. We have a jade, sapphire, Simeon, and the color was green. Agatha, which is Levi, it color's red, white, and black striped. Carbuncle or sardius is for Judah, bluish green. Lapis or lazuli, topaz, Issachar, and is blue. Quartz crystals, carbuncle, Zabulon, clear, is a clear stone. Turquoise, beryl, that's the tribe of Dan, that's blue. Amethyst or jasper, that's for the tribe of Naphtali, that's purple. Agatha amber, diamond. Gad, the color's gray. Aquamarine or onyx, Asher, blue-green. An onyx stone, Joseph, is black. Ephraim is ligure, Manasseh is an agatha. Opal, amethyst is for Benjamin. Stone possessing all the colors. So Benjamin had all the colors. In the opinion of Yohanan ben Uziel, the author of the Aramaic translated commentary on the Bible, okay, which is the Targum, the children of Israel's name were inscribed on the breastplate stone in the order of their birth, and were therefore arranged in the following manner. This is according to one position in Judaism, okay? It's not the normal one, it's only one position. So when you study this out, remember, it's just one position. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Dan, Naphtali. So according to Jonathan ben Uziel, Reuben, Simeon, and Levi is the top. Judah, Dan, Levi, Naphtali is follows. So instead of four across, it would be three. Four lines of three, starting from the top down. From right to left, obviously. Then you go Gad, Asher, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin. Now, this is up for discussion. We don't really know exactly. It's been kind of lost. But, you know, as long as the 12 tribes are in there, I guess, you know, they have to be in order of their birth. All right. Another Aramaic translation. The Targum Jerusalemi places the order of the tribes according to the matriarchs. The six sons of Leah, the two sons of Bilhah, the two sons of Zilpah, and the two sons of Rachel. So if this is true, then the order will be Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, Joseph, Benjamin. That's the way this does come. There's a lot of discussion amongst rabbis, which is the order in the breastplate. There's also a tradition which Moses received at Mount Sinai, the Mount Sinai Revelation, with all 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet should be present on the stones. Since all these letters are not found in the name of Jacob's progeny, several other words were also engraved upon the stones. The names of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because of the verse that says the tribes of Jeshurun. One opinion is that the words Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob appeared at the top of the first stone over the name Reuben, and the other word on the last stone. Others maintain that all these extra letters were divided amongst the stones. Now that's just a tradition, okay? Now, like the two sardonic shoulder stones, the Bible states that the purpose of the 12 stone is to be a perpetual remembrance before the Lord. In other words, if to have the breastplate is to have the 12 tribes always in remembrance before Yahweh. So he will remember the covenant he made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. When the high priest bore the breastplate into the holy place, Israel was remembered for peace. The sages taught that the ephah served to invoke the cause of Israel's sustenance in the material welfare. The ephod is basically a purple garment that you put over the white linen cloth. And the breastplate, her salvation and deliverance from her enemies. So you see, what you see here is two sardonic stones on the right and on the left. And basically they have six children of the names of the six children of Israel on one side and six names of the children of Israel on the other one. So he will wear that as basically a shoulder pad. You know what I mean? So not only the stones on the breastplate, but also in the two stones that were in the shoulders. Ezekiel 28:12 talks about this. Says, "Son of man, take up a lamentation upon the kings of Tyrus and say to him, thus says Adonai Elohim, do you seal up the sum, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty? The breastplate was described as for honor and beauty." Remember that, okay? It says, "And the most intricate and beautiful garment of the priest wore." That's the beautiful thing he wore. The ephod is beautiful. It had all the colors, basically. It's got a scarlet, it's got white, and it's got blue, okay? So it made like a purple. Okay, all those three colors make purple. You know that. So the red, the white, and the blue make purple. So it's very significant because every color and everything has a meaning. White is righteousness. Sin is red, and the blue is the heavenlies. So when you combine those things, then you make the purple, which is royalty. So basically, that's what the press was living like, dressing like. And Ezekiel 28:13 says, "Thou hast been in Eden, the garden of Elohim. Every precious stone was your covering. The sardius, topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, the jasper, the sapphire, the emerald, and the carbuncle. And gold." Okay? "The workmanship of your tablets and the pipes was prepared in you in the day that you was created." It's talking about the enemy. Says, "These precious stones are 9 of the 12 that are in Exodus 28. So what you see here is it's making a connection between Ezekiel 28, okay, that person who was in charge on the heavenly tabernacle, on heavenly, you know, worship, with 9 stones instead of 12. And there's 3 stones missing. The 9 of the 12 stones that are mentioned are here mentioned in Exodus 28 and Revelation 20. But the missing rows, for the ones for Lucifer, the one in charge of the worship, who fell from sin, is Ligur, Agathis, and Amethyst. So there are 3 stones in Ezekiel 28 that are missing of the 12. This is a mystery to me. I'm still researching this. I'm still trying to find out what this is all about. Okay, let's move on. There are many interpretations for the meaning of the stones and the tribes they represent. However, most commentators and rabbinical scholars believe the missing row may be from Ephraim, Ligur, Gad, Agatha, and Naphtali, Amethyst. Although some references material give different information. Again, I'm giving you both perspectives so you can have the information. Note that inscribed on the 12 precious stones, only 20 of the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet are represented. This is what I was telling you earlier before the break. See, the Chet and the Tet are missing, the 2 letters. Out of the 22, 2 are missing. Together, these 2 letters spell the Hebrew word for sin, which means chet or chata, okay? The root of sin is absent from the breastplate of righteousness. So we see that the high priest who had the breastplate, in the names of the children of Israel, there are 2 letters missing in the breastplate, which means that our high priest is perfect and there's no sin in him. Now, the priests were divided in 24 priestly courses. This is very important. Each course will serve 2 weeks of the year in the temple during the feast. They can go at any time, but as a family, as a line of families, they will go in and serve in the temple for 2 weeks of the year in the on the great feast, okay? Now, the priests who were responsible for the daily service in the holy temple were divided into 24 separate shifts. These groups were made up of men who hailed from all parts of the land. The duration of each shift during was 1 week. Okay. During that week, each representative's shifts will be entirely responsible to carry out all the duties, all the daily functions of the temple for that week. Thus, the priests took turns throughout the year in a manner that can be compared to military reserve duty. One will come into Jerusalem for his obligatory period for service in the temple. So the way they would do it is, you have to say that I start serving, today is Shabbat, and I start today. Then I will leave at the end of the next Shabbat. And then the next priestly courses will come in at the beginning of the last Shabbat. Okay? Now, the way the priestly courses were done was, it developed from Moses all the way to David. In Moses, you have 8 courses. 4 because of Eliezer, and 4 for Itamar. Then in Samuel's time, there were 16 courses. He extended us to 16 courses. And then during the time of David, it went up to 24. 16 from the line of Eliezer, and 8 from the line of Itamar. Those are high priests, the priestly courses. Now the duty times is 2 8-day times a year, Sabbath to Sabbath. Okay, so they will come in on the outgoing of the morning lamb, and they will come in the incoming on the evening lamb. That's the way they used to come in. Okay, perfect order. During Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles, they will all have to be present. Okay, during the great feast, they all have to be present. But throughout the week, throughout the year, they have duty. 1 week at a time, 2 weeks of the year, and then during the great feast. Okay? Now, the priestly courses is composed of 24 names. You see, you got to understand that numbers mean something in Scripture. If you do a study on the 24 courses, you get every single one of those names that you see there. By the way, I have a few names missing, so be patient. I went in and put in on the 24 names of the priestly courses, and I found their definitions from the Hebrew. And in their names, in the 24 names, if you want to do a really cool study, you can find the whole prophetic picture of the restoration of all things. But what's interesting is that as you read, course number 1, in Herohariv, Yediah, Harim, Seorim, Malchiyah, Hakos, Abia. This is very significant because John the Baptist came from the line of Abia. Okay? And then you have immediately after that, Yeshua. And then immediately after that, Shechaniah. And then you have Eliashiv, Hakim, and Chuppah. So you know Chuppah is a wedding canopy. But it's interesting because John the Baptist was from the line of Abia through Zechariah. And Yeshua came after him, literally Yeshua. So here already prophetically cast lots. They cast lots for this duty. And at the time of David, they cast lots for the priestly duties. And here that even back then, that Abia came before Yeshua. Even in the Tanakh talks about that. So that Zechariah was the father of John the Baptist who came from Abia. So this has already been completely prophesied from the get-go. Okay? Now, as we see, let's review real quick. We have different fires on the altar. We have the big pyre fire. We have the coals fire. We have the tamid offering. And we have the apple, the ashes in the middle of the altar right there, how the priest used to officiate on the whole time. Now, Tamid 1:2 says, "He who wants to take up the ashes from the altar gets up early and immerses before the superintendent comes by." And at that time, does the superintendent come by? Not all the times are the same. This is very significant because sometimes he comes at the cock crow. Remember? Early, early in the morning. So in other words, the priest so will come in the middle of the night to the people who are making the watch. Okay, the watch of the temple, or the people who wanted to do the worship. He wouldn't come at the same time all the time. Sometimes he comes at cockcrow, or near then, earlier or later. So you didn't know when he was going to come. What's interesting was during the temple service, if the priests who were in charge of keeping the order or the watch, the temple guard, okay, they will fall asleep, then the priests will come over, and he will grab some coals from the altar, go to where the priest was sleeping, and he will put the coals on the linen garments, and you know that will catch fire right away. So it was a way of shame if they would go out there, and now they're naked walking around because they fell asleep on the job. That's why the Bible tells us, you know, to be the children of light, not to fall asleep. Paul is using that language the whole time, so we will learn how to always be aware because your high priest can come at any time. And he will, you know, he will just wake you up the way you don't want to be woken up. Now, the superintendent came and knocked on the door, and they opened it to him. He said to them, "Let him who has immersed come and cast lots." Now, what I'm going to talk to you about, the way they used to cast lots in the first century in the temple to create order. Whoever won. In other words, you come in there. There was one time that the people who already officiated in the altar of incense never came for lots. The altar of incense, like Zechariah and Luke, you know, he only did that job once. That duty only came to him once in his lifetime. That's it. Never again, never before, and never after. That was the only time he got to offer the altar of incense in the holy place, and the only time he did it, the angel appeared to him. Very, very significant. So now let's talk about, you know, the dedication of how everything works. Now, to do the Passover, casting of lots, you require like 10 priests to take care of the lamb. But according to Alfred Edersheim, on the temple and ministry and service. In chapter 6, says, last number of priests needed so complicated service, and one enjoying such a frequent services must always have kept a large number of priests busy in the courts of the temple. This was especially the case on the great festivals. And if the magnificent temple could hold its 210,000 to 250,000 worshipers, the liturgy, music, and ritual were equally gorgeous. It cannot wonder that it required a multitude of white robes, priests, properly to discharge this ministry. It was a huge job. There were a lot of people officiating in the temple. And all you saw was a host of white garments going through. Tradition has it that on the Day of Atonement, no less than 500 priests were there to assist on the service. No less than 500 priests were there to assist. But only the high priest can go into the Holy of Holies. Okay? Let's talk about the slain on the lamb. While the Savior still tarried, okay, while Messiah is still not back, with the other disciples outside the city, Peter and John were completing their preparations. They followed the motley crowd, all leading their sacrificial lambs up to the Temple Mount, okay? Here they were grouped into three divisions, according to Alfred Adamsheim's book on the temple. While all the people who followed the temple to go kill the lamb, getting ready for Passover, they were grouped into three divisions. Already, evening sacrifice had been offered, okay? So ordinarily, it was between 2:30 and 3:30. But on the eve of the Passover, as we have seen, it was killed an hour earlier. Many people believe that Yeshua died on a Friday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's impossible. It didn't happen. You may ask the question, Rico, how do you know? I know because the Mishnah tells me and Alfred Edensheim tells me that when they used to kill the lamb, if it was not before the Sabbath, the regular Sabbath day, if Passover didn't fall before the Passover day, then they will kill it at between 2:30 and 3:30, more preferably at 3. But if the Passover will fall on a Friday afternoon and then the sundown, which is already Friday night, which is already Sabbath, okay, then they will kill it an hour earlier, between 12:30 and 1:30, so they can get ready for Passover service. And if the 14th of Nisan fell from the Friday, rather from Thursday on Eve to Friday at Eve, 63 hours earlier, so as to avoid any needless breach of the Sabbath, on the occasion to which we referred the evening sacrifice, they slain it at 1:30, okay, and offered at 2:30. But before the incense was burned or the lambs were trimmed, the Passover sacrifice had to be offered. So here we see that on Passover, if the Passover will fall before a weekly Sabbath, then they will do it earlier in the day so they can still do the whole service and still have time to go partake of the Passover Seder. It was done in this way. First, of the three festive divisions and with the Passover lambs, was admitted within the courts of the priests. Each division must consist of no less than 30 people. Three divisions, 10 priests. The symbolical number of the divine and completeness, okay? Now, immediately, the massive gates were closed behind them. The priests drew a threefold blast from their silver trumpets, and the Passover was slain. Very important, because silver is redemption. Altogether, the scene was most impressive, okay? All along the court, up to the altar of burnt offering, priests stood in two rows, okay? The one holding golden, and the other one holding silver bowls. In these, the blood of the Passover lambs, okay? So they were holding a golden, okay, bowl and a silver bowl, and they were holding the lamb of the lambs that were being slain, and they will pass over 10 priests for one lamb, okay? Which each Israelite slew, okay? Says, in this bowls, the blood of the Passover lambs, which the Israelites slew for himself as representative of his company of the Passover Seder, was caught up by a priest who handed it to the colleagues, receiving back an empty bowl. So they will pass it like in a chain reaction, you know. So they get this one, they pass it over this one, they come back, they give me the empty one so we can continue. So the bowls with blood will pass up to the priest at the altar, who jerked it in one jet at the base of the altar. So they would just pour it at the base of the altar. So you have 10 priests. I will come, kill the lamb. The first priest get the blood, and he passes it all the way to the priest who's standing next to the base of the altar, and there he just basically pours it on the altar. While it was going on, the most solemn hymn or psalms of praise was raised Remember, Psalms 113 through 118 was sung during this time. The Levites leading in song, and the offerer either repeating after them or merely responding. Every first line of the psalm was repeated by the people, so it was sung acrostically. Let me show you how that was done. When I was a kid, I used to go to this Pentecostal church, right? And they used to read the verses like that. They would go acrostic first. They would read, "Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor in the path of the sinner, nor the sits in the sound of scornful." And then the rest of the congregation would read the next verse. So that's how it was done in the temple. Every first line of the psalm was repeated by the people, while to each of the others they responded by an hallelujah, or, you know, which means praise Yahweh. This service of songs consisting of the so-called Hallel Psalms, which is comprised of Psalms 113 through 118 that I mentioned to you earlier. All right, let's continue. So as we go along, we're going to see some of the utensils and some of the vessels that you see in the temple right there that has to do with the wine and the water libation, the one you see right there on the screen right now. And then you see the priest standing on the corner of the altar where they had the silver drainage system that he would do the libation offering there. Okay? Now, which type of sacrifices were there in the temple? Inside the temple was the burnt offering, the grain offering, peace offering, sin offering, and the guilt offering. All those five sacrifices were done for unwillful, ignorant sin. I need you to understand this because Yeshua didn't come to do away with any of those. Those are not the ones Yeshua came to do away with. Yeshua came to do away with the one on Yom Kippur that only Yahweh can forgive willful defined sin. Okay? He came to do away with, that's what the whole book of Hebrews is all about. The book of Hebrews is trying to convey to you the message that Yeshua came to be a higher priest in the order of Melchizedek who can intercede on your behalf and who doesn't die. And he came on to officiate for Yom Kippur, to do away with willful, rebellious sin that only Yahweh can forgive, and Yeshua being our high priest, he can intercede on our behalf, being a greater offering and a greater priest unto Yahweh. So therefore now, what we're going to do, let's go read about Midot, chapter 1, verse 3. Midot of the Mishnah says this, 5 gates were in the wall of the Temple Mount, 2 hood the gate at the south, serving for entry and exit, Kiponos gate on the west, serving for entry and exit. The Tati gate on the north, serving no purpose at all. And the eastern gate, on it is a picture of the walled city of Shushan, through which the high priest who burned the red cow, the red heifer, okay, and the cow, and all the assists of the ritual will go to the Mount of Olives. You find this also in Parah 4:1. Parah Adumah. In the Mishnah, Parah Adumah 4:1. So you see there were different gates. 2 in the south, there were 1 in the west, there was 1 in the north, and 1 in the east. So as we see here, there were gates of the wall. As you go back to the wall of Israel, you get to see that. Midot 2:4 tells you that all the walls were there in Jerusalem were high except for the eastern wall of the temple. Okay? For the priest who burned the red cow stands at the top of the Mount of Olives and takes his direction looking directly into the door of the temple, which was almost like 80 feet high at the time of tossing of the blood. In other words, nothing came in on the red heifer sacrifice. Nothing came in into the animal, the meat of the animal. Only the blood came into the holy place. He tossed it from the Mount of Olives, and then he took it back to the veil in the holy place. But the animal was taken outside the camp, exactly where Yeshua was taken for his death. Okay? Hebrews 13 tells us about this, if we understand temple service language. Let's read it. In Hebrews 13 verses... read the verse so you understand. I hope and pray you're enjoying this. I'm trying to give you a lot of information. You know, so much I still got to share with you. And we're taking it one step at a time because there's a lot of information. So therefore, we're going to try to get through, trying to give you at least an essence of what was going on in the temple during the day, during the weekdays. And then we're going to focus on some of the feasts. Passover, Yom Teruah, and then Yom Kippur, and then Sukkot. We're going to try to do a teaching so you can have a better idea of what was happening in the temple doing that and how we have the connection with Yeshua. In Hebrews chapter 13, verses 11, says, For the bodies of those beasts whose blood is brought into the sanctuary by high priests for sin are burnt outside the camp. Outside the camp is an idiomatic expression for east gate. Then verse 12 says, therefore Yeshua also, that he may sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered outside the gate. Outside the gate is an expression for what we just read earlier, the Shushan gate, which is basically the one that is the eastern gate. Okay? So now, what do altars do? The altars, you bring the sacrifice, they don't save. They allow you to come near korban. Sacrifice, the word korban in Hebrew is the word sacrifice is korban. And the word korban basically means to come near him. Okay? The sacrifices did show God's mercy and grace. So we have to understand that the altar was not there to bring you salvation, was there to bring you reconciliation, redemption, reconciliation, sanctification. You'll be redeemed when you bring the lamb. You know, you got to bring in the firstborn. You got to redeem the firstborn. You got to do all kinds of things to teach you that you need Elohim to keep you always in the forefront of his perfect plan. So now, the references for this study so far have been Alfred Edensheim's book, The Temple, the Mishnah, and the Temple Institute in Jerusalem, okay? So, you know, this is something that we need to worry about. As we keep studying these principles, as we're going to go through, we understand how things work in the temple. So as we study the language, and we study the idiomatic expressions, and we know what's going on, then as we keep reading in the Bible, let me give you an example. Let's go to John. It's chapter 19, verse 23. Listen to this. It says, then the soldiers, when they had crucified Yeshua, took his garments and made four parts. To each soldier a part, and also a tunic. Listen to this. Now the tunic was without seam, woven from top to one piece. That's the way you used to woven the garments of the priests. Now in the temple period, the priests had double stitch around the neck. They were not supposed to tear it. Then we're not supposed to just do this, just tear it. Now, why is this so significant? Because in verse 24 says, they said, therefore amongst themselves, let us not tear it, but cast lots for it, whose it shall be, but the scripture might be fulfilled, which says, they divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. That's Psalms 22:18. But what's really peculiar about this is that it was illegal for the high priest to rent his garment. In Matthew chapter 26, you see that when Yeshua is talking to Caiaphas, and I'm going to cover a lot more of this in my study on the book of, on the day of Yom Kippur in the temple, we're going to cover this, but I want to give you a heads up on that, okay, so you understand where I'm coming from. In Matthew 26, you have this, it says this, it says, 63, but Yeshua kept silent, and the high priest answered and said to him, I adjure you by the living Elohim that you tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God. Yeshua said to him, it is as you said, nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of Elohim, at the right hand of the power, and coming on the cloud of heaven. Then the high priest tore his garments, saying, he has spoken blasphemy. Okay, but the point here is that he tore his garments. Let's go to Leviticus. It says that the priests should not rend their garments. Because as soon as, remember when Aaron, his sons died because they brought strange fire into the camp? That they were not allowed, they died, and Aaron was not allowed to mourn. Why is that? Hebraic way of mourning is ripping your garments, renting. Even in Hasidic circles, they have a pocket. If they have the suit, they rent the pocket when they have a death in the family. So check this out. We know that during the great feast, the high priest was basically taken away from his family for 7 days before the feast to allow him to be ritually pure, so that way when the feast was there, he can officiate, especially on Yom Kippur. So you have two high priests that they will prepare another high priest to get this high priest ready, so that if this guy will be defiled, this guy can take his place at any time. Okay, so now we go to Yeshua. Yeshua is the high priest in the order of Melchizedek. John the Baptist already died. The immerser, he already died. Therefore, there's no longer a kosher priest. Caiaphas is doing the role of the priesthood, but he bought in the priesthood, giving the most money to Rome. So he bought in the priesthood. So he's not a legitimate Levite priest. But you see, Even the Mishnah tells you that in the first century, the priests were many because they were defiled and they were bought into the priesthood. So here we have Caiaphas trying to be the priest, and then when he hears what Yeshua says, he rents his garments. Oh, check this out. So when he rented his garments, Caiaphas' priesthood becomes null and void, and Yeshua comes in and takes his place, just like they used to do in the feast, especially in Yom Kippur, when they have a priest that they used to sprinkle with the ashes of the red heifer on the third and the seventh day, the waters of sanctification, on the third and the seventh day, for fear that he may get defiled, so he will not be able to do the service. You find that in the book of Hebrews chapter 9. We're going to cover that later too. So what's really peculiar here is that now Caiaphas rents his garments, with according to the book of Leviticus, he said, no. His priesthood is null and void. So when you go back to John 19, and you read verse 23 and 24, and it says in verse 24, they said among themselves, let us not tear it. Which one? His garment that was woven from the top to the bottom. Did you know that if they would have rented Yeshua's garment, the white garments, Yeshua would have been disqualified as the high priest? See, if you study temple service, that piece of information is like my highlight in my Bible. See, you see that little highlight in Scripture? See, that is important to me. Anybody who reads my Bible, they will go to the highlights. It's like when you were in college. Remember when you were in college? I know you do. I do. When I was in college, I never read the whole book. I was too busy playing baseball. But what I would do, I would go get the used books. I would buy used books, especially the ones that were the marked, highlighted the most. And I was hoping that the guy who owned that book before me was a lot smarter than me, because I didn't have time to read through the whole thing. And usually, you know, the professor's syllabus never really changed. They do the same thing over and over and over and over. So I figure, hey, I'm going to buy the book, a used book, somebody who read it. Hopefully he marked it, because those are the highlights of the teaching, and those are the highlights of that teacher, so I don't have to do the whole thing. I know, you're probably thinking how lazy he was. Hey, you know, I was busy playing baseball. I just wanted to hit a baseball. I didn't want to study the whole time, okay? Now that I'm in Torah, I study every little bitty thing. And here we have that the fulfillment of Yeshua, when people read it in John chapter 19 and they see that the garments will not rent, many people will look at it like, oh, it's just information about Yeshua dying on the tree. But why is that so important to John? See, John understood temple service. I believe John was a Levite. He had very, very, very well in information about the temple. Remember, he knew about it. So anyway, let's see how we go from here. Let's talk a little bit about how they used to cast lots for the temple, okay? Now, there were groups made up of men who hailed from other parts of the land. The duration of each shift, remember, the priestly shift, was for 1 week. I'm going to recap on that. During that week, each respective shift will be entirely responsible to carry everything that happened in the temple, right? Now, what's really interesting that those who were entrusted in the holy temple attended to their duties with great joy and enthusiasm. Being a descendant of Aaron was indeed a great merit and honor, and they understood full well the importance of the work for all of Israel. Now, the priests were exceedingly zealous in their mission, and all wanted the opportunity to conduct the divine services. There were only a specific number of daily tasks. However, it was impossible for everyone to attend to these at once. In other words, they needed to create a little order because there were too much to do, okay? It says, in order to give each priest the shift of the shift an equal opportunity to officiate in the holy service, a system was devised whereby all those who desire to serve will receive their chance to qualify equally, okay? The assignments of temple services were designated by special lotteries which were held each day in the temple. Okay, so they cast lots for the garments of Yeshua, just like they used to cast lots in the temple for the duties of the temple. It's very interesting. All the priests of the family clan who were serving that day will participate in this drawing of lots, which was concluded by an official who entrusted with his role. So that was perfect order. Now, the lottery drawing was held 4 different times during the day. Each day, okay, 4 separate drawings were held. Responsibility for the most important temple services was designated at these gatherings. In other words, you cannot just show up and do whatever you wanted to do. You showed up, and even if you were a priest or you were a Levite, you still needed to come over there and sit there, and then you got your job. Okay? So it was like this. And while all the tasks could have been determined by one drawing, it was preferred to reassemble all the priests four times for separate drawings. Thus the courtyard was filled with the priests a number of times throughout the day. And this is considered a great honor for the master who dwells in the house. In keeping with the verse in Psalms chapter 54, verse 15, "And we walk to the house of Yahweh in company." That verse is composed in Psalm 54, 15, based on what the Levites used to see every time they used to draw lots. Basically, all the Levites would gather together because they wanted to officiate, and they were eager to do so. So as you see on the screen right now, you see the different Levites there casting, you know, they were doing lots in order for them to be able to officiate on the altar. I would love to be there. The first lottery was for the removal of the ashes at dawn, the removal of the ashes in the morning. The first lottery each day determined which priest will carry out the very first daily task in the holy temple service, the removal of the ashes from the altar. The service of removing of the ashes is one of the most instructive commandments which relates to the outer altar. In Leviticus chapter 6, verse 8 to 11, says this, "And Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, Command Aaron and his sons, saying, This is the law of the burnt offering. It is a burnt offering because of the burn upon the altar all night unto the morning, and the fire on the altar shall be burned in it. And the priest shall put on his linen garment, and his linen breeches shall put on his flesh, and take up the ashes which the fire hath consumed with the burnt offering of the altar on the altar, and he shall put them beside the altar. And he shall put off his garments, and put other garments, and carry forth the ashes outside the camp to a clean place." Okay? Very important. Now the lottery overseer, the leader of the lottery, arrived and announced himself by knocking on the door of the priest's chambers, the place of the fire. That was a location in which they could keep themselves warm in the morning. They would do a mikvah, and after they do the mikvah, they get dressed with the garments, and they go to a place to keep warm. And then the leader, the overseer, he would knock at the door, and then they would all come out. When they opened the door, they greeted him. And he bids them, he says, "Whoever has immersed himself, let him come to draw lots, to determine who will merit the first service of the day." Now the priests make their way to the chamber of hewn stone, the chamber of hewn stone where the lotteries took place. Very important, because that's the place they took Yeshua when they judged him. Okay? Now this was the same compartment which the house of the great Sanhedrin. Yeshua was there. By the way, according to evidence that we have from Talmud Mishnah, that when the great earthquake happened, when they no longer could officiate in the Sanhedrin Council in the great room on the hewn stone because it was damaged. So what's interesting here is that Yeshua was the last judgment that they had on that place. Very significant. It says, "Upon returning to the chamber of hewn stone, after the wood piles have been arranged on top of the altar, the priests once again gather before the overseer for the second daily lottery." So the first lottery had to do with the ashes. You did that, then you meet again, and now you do the second one. The second drawing had to do with determining the distribution of the number of various assignments pertaining to the sacrifices and offerings of the tamid, the daily sacrifice. Now the overseer called out to the priest to draw from the following task for the second lottery of the daily sacrifice. Now which would slaughter the sacrifice? Now let's just check this out. You got to have priests casting lots, but which one will slaughter it? Who will receive the blood and dash it on the altar? Who will remove the excess ashes from the inner golden altar? Who would do the altar of incense within the sanctuary? And who would attend to the wicks of the menorah cleansing? Okay, so you have different roles within the second lottery. The second lottery was to determine all of those works. And each priest had a particular job. Now, this is very significant for us in the body of Messiah. In the body of Messiah, we have a problem. Everybody wants to be a leader. But we know that in the temple, not all of them were leaders. There was only one leader, that was the high priest. Okay? We only have one leader, that's a high priest. Okay? And we have to be a kingdom of priests. We have a role in the kingdom. And this is something we need to understand. What have you asked yourself, what is the role that the Father has for you? That's the question you have to ask yourself. Now let's talk about the cubs of used oil and ash. This involves six priests, by the way. Now which priest will bring the parts of the sacrifice to the altar ramp? Now, they're trying to determine all these things. Let me review again. They're trying to determine which priest would slaughter the sacrifice, which one would receive the blood and dash it on the altar, which one would remove the excess ashes from the inner golden altar in the sanctuary, which priest would offer the incense, the incense inside the holy place, and which priest would attend to the wicks of the menorah, which priest would bring the parts of the sacrifice to the altar ramp. Like a slide that I showed you earlier. But this one requires six priests. So for this duty, for this particular task, you needed six priests. Okay? You know, one will carry the leg, one will carry the head, one will carry the hind leg, one will carry the other parts of the body. And they will toss it into the altar, and they will burn there for the whole time. Now, they also determine who will bring the fine flour for the accompanying meal offering to the altar. And who will bring up the high priest's meal offering? So who will pour the wine libation? There were 13 different priests that received appointment on this lottery alone. So for the first lottery, you have the one for the ashes. But for the second lottery, you needed 13 priests to officiate for that lottery alone, for the service. So you can tell that working in the temple was no piece of cake. There was perfect order, perfect musical, perfect everything. There was a family for the bread. There was a family for the incense. There was a family for the music. It is believed that the priest, to start the priesthood, you start at 30 years old. Okay? But what happens is, when you start at 30 years old, and in some other places it's 25. The conclusion was that they will begin to start studying the mysteries and all the hidden esoteric things, the deeper things of music and how to prepare the incense. So they will take the priest for 5 years and they will prepare them. In other words, at the age of 25, they will allow them in the temple and they start teaching them about music, about the harp, about the incense, about the bread. So from the line, from that family, from the line of Aptinas and the line for the people who make the bread and the people who you did the music, the Levites who did the music, so they will take those priests and they will teach them for 5 years the mysteries of the music. In regards to the incense, they will take them, this is the way we used to make that incense go up in smoke like a column to the heavens. There was a particular mystery that people still don't know. Only that family of the incense, Aptinas, who really know how to do it. Now, it is believed that even the descendants of Aptinas, you know, they were not allowed to wear perfume. And the women were not allowed to wear perfume because the incense alone was a perfume to them. And they did not want the people to think that they were using the temple service incense for perfume for their personal gain. So in that family, they were not allowed to wear perfumes because of that. Now, so there's 13 there. As you see now, we got the third lottery now. We got the third daily lottery, and that's the altar of incense. And as you can see on the screen there, and some of you that are listening to me, if you go to my website, you can download this PowerPoint, which is called The Temple and the Daily Sacrifices, And there you can see what everything that's happening here. And you see the high priest with the golden garments doing the altar of incense. Doing the altar of incense, not in the Holy of Holies, doing the altar of incense in the holy place. Now, the third lottery was to determine who was going to do this. Now, watch this. The third lottery was unique. This was held to determine who would have a chance to officiate at the incense offering, which according to Jewish tradition, it says, was the most beloved part of the temple service in God's eyes. Why? It was influential in subduing evil. It was a characteristic, a quality, aided by implying the aspect divine mercy and benevolence in the world. Because when you offer incense, you are interceding for your neighbor. You are interceding for your country. You are interceding for your family. So it's a sweet aroma unto the nostrils of the Lord. So when you hear that expression, you will be a sweet aroma unto the nostrils. That's really what it means. It comes from temple service. Very, very important. Okay? Now, an extraordinary tradition relates that because it was so beloved to the Creator, He sought to reward those who attended to it in an unusual fashion. We saw this unusual fashion by revealing Himself to Zechariah through the angel Gabriel. To the angel, He heard the prayers of Zechariah, so the angel appeared to give him a message. So it says, whose effect will manifest immediately. However, officiating in the incense offering became wealthy. The person who officiated in the altar of incense became wealthy. and enjoy a blessing of heaven-sent bounty and prosperity from then on. This concept is also reflected by the verse in Deuteronomy 33:10, which says, They shall teach Jacob thy judgment and Israel thy law, and they shall put incense before you and burn sacrifices upon your altar in regards to the sacrifices and the priests. Verse 11 says, blessed the Lord, his sustenance. His substance. See, bless Lord his substance. Who's? The priest who is officiating on the altar. And accept the work of his hands. Smite through the loins of them that arise against him, and them that hate him, and they shall raise not against him. So when you bring forth the altar of incense, they believe, based on these verses, that the Creator will give them a special blessing, and he will bless his sustenance. There's a tradition in the temple that if the person who officiated was poor, amongst all of the priests, they will collect money to give to him so he will be wealthy, so he will tell the whole world that the Creator of the universe gave him the sustenance for being righteous and presenting himself before the Lord. The incense service for a priest was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Thus, in order to give all the priests an opportunity, listen to this, to avail themselves in this divine blessing, and so that no one man should monopolize. In other words, it's not like you're going to allow one person to do it every time. I would have loved to do it every time, you know. You know, I mean, who wouldn't want to become in the presence of the Lord? So I think when we want to come to the presence and pray on behalf of the people, we kind of become selfish a little bit. But in this case, they didn't want that. He says, such favor by receiving more than once. It was established that unlike the other aspects of the temple service and casting of lots, each priest may officiate at the incense offering only once in his lifetime. And afterwards, he may not apply again. So when it came to the offering of the altar of incense in the holy place, that only you can go cast lots for it once. That's it. It says, the priests who arrived at this third gathering and knew that if they merit to perform the service, it will be an opportunity that they should have just once in a lifetime. For the winner would not even be allowed to participate in the drawing again. So we know that Zechariah, that was his only time ever. He waited his whole life. And that day he had the privilege to get the altar of incense. And what happened to him? The angel appeared to him. Okay, good. The Talmud expounds on this and states emphatically that all the hundreds of years that the temple stood, no man ever repeated the incense altar, the service. No man ever repeated it, only done once. Everybody got a chance to intercede on behalf of Israel. I'm talking about the priest, the Kohen. This fact in itself translated into an amazing detail. There were so many priests in each family clan that a lottery gathering never once took place. And this scene was replayed every day over many hundreds of years, wherein everyone present had already performed the service. But they always found somebody who never did. This is amazing. Okay, this is incredible. I really love that. Now the fourth daily lottery, was open for the participation of all the priests. So now all the priests can do that one. The only one that not all the priests can do was the one on the altar of incense in the holy place in the morning and the evening, okay? Says, in fact, states the Mishnah, since it follows the incense drawing, which was only eligible to newcomers, by contrast, the overseer or the leader of this lottery would now cry out, both newcomers and veterans alike, let all come to draw lots. So now after the newcomer or the new guy who went to the holy place and offer incense, now they can come together. The new ones and the ones who were there before, they can come and do the fourth lottery here. This gathering now ascertained who merited to bring the parts of the sacrifice from the altars ramp to the top, okay, where the sacrifices were consumed in the altar's fire. We will recall that as a part of the second lottery, six priests merited to bring the part of the daily sacrifice from the place from where the sacrifice was slaughtered and prepared to over to the ramp. Now, however, the portions are left there on the ramp. So the guys who slaughter it, who prepared it, then they cast lots, and they gave the duty to take it to the ramp. And that priest left it at the ramp. Now, in the fourth lottery, then the guys who were appointed in the fourth lottery would take the meat that was left over at the ramp by the priest who did the second lottery. I hope you follow me. Then they took the meat and took it to the altar from the ramp. Perfect order. Everybody had a role. You didn't see the musicians trying to all do the sacrifice. You didn't see the high priest wanting to do musicians. You didn't see the bread makers wanting to do incense. You didn't see the incense. In other words, you're not micromanaging everything. If you're a leader of a congregation, you want to do it all, you're in trouble. That doesn't follow biblical protocol. Okay? The biblical protocol is that everybody has a role in the kingdom. There's perfect order in the kingdom. Everybody has a role. We will recall that as part of the second lottery, six priests merit to bring the parts on the daily sacrifices from the place where the sacrifices were slaughtered and prepare and over to the ramp. However, the portions are left there on the ramp on the eastern side of the lower half of the ramp. The priest who now wins the fourth lottery is he who will actually bring these segments up to the altar. Some claim that the same number of the priests who brought the portion over to the ramp, six, now bring them up as well. So the fourth lottery, they believe that there were also six priests that received the lottery to bring the piece of the animals. Now he who merits to perform this task places the portions on the altar fire and pours it on the accompanying libation as well. At the conclusion of the fourth lottery, now you have, when the priests all arrived in the early morning to participate in the lotteries, they were all attired in the priestly vestments. In the event of mattering in the lottery, if they got the lottery, each will be able to commence with the sacred task immediately, okay? After the priests had concluded their sacred duties within the sanctuary, bowed down and departed, they exited the sanctuary and stand upon the 12 steps which lead down to the area before the altar. You got the 15 steps that takes you from the woman's court to the Levitical court. But then from the altar, outer altar, to inside the holy place, okay, there were 12 steps, typifying the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, the priests who attended to the inner altar ashes, the menorah wicks, the shovel, and the incense all stand to the right of their colleagues who brought the parts of the sacrifice up on the altar. This is very intricate. I mean, there's a lot of work going on here. They hold all the vessels they have been using in their service, the golden basket which holds the ashes and the wicks, the shovel, and the incense utensils. Now they place all these vessels down and face the congregation. Turning to all the people who have gathered in the court, they extend their hands and recite the Aaronic blessing. So this is the only time that the priest will give the back to the holy place. They're looking towards the courtyard. And they do, Yevarechecha Adonai v'yishmerecha, Ya'el Adonai panavelecha v'chuneka, Yisa Adonai panavelecha v'yasem lecha shalom. Okay, so they will do the Aaronic blessing. It says, Yahweh bless you and keep you. Yahweh make his face shine upon you, be gracious to you. Yahweh lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. And they shall put my name upon the children of Israel, and I will bless them. Thus says the Lord. So here, if you see the slide, you see how the priests who are officiating in the holy place with the ramp, the wicks of the menorah, everything else, they will stand right outside facing the people, giving them the blessing. And this is very significant because there's so much to talk about and there's so much to look into. In the next hour, we're going to be talking about the candlestick, the menorah. We're going to be talking about the showbread. We're going to talk about the altar of incense. And we're going to talk about the Ark of the Covenant. Okay, the Ark of the Covenant was not found in the second temple. And it was in the first temple. So we're going to talk about all those beautiful things later on. I am excited. I am so happy. I am delighted to have the privilege and the honor to go to your homes and share with you about the temple of Yahweh. I want you to become aware with everything that was happening in the temple. Everything. You might say, well, you know, you're not mentioning Yeshua very much. This is all about him. He's trying to establish order in the camp. And it's important for you as believers in the Messiah that you would understand what was happening in the first century and in the first temple. Because you see, when we come in the kingdom, when we come to the kingdom, there will be a temple there. It's called Ezekiel's temple. And there will be priests officiating. So you have a greater understanding of what's going to happen in the millennial reign. Okay? I'll tell you, there's so much information we're trying to deal with. And we got the golden candlestick, which is a menorah, which is found, is basically found in the south side of the temple. It's interesting because it's got seven branches. And let me leave you hanging here for the next hour. It's got seven branches. Bereshit, Bara, Elohim, Et, Hashamayim, Vaet, Haaretz. If you put the candlestick, right, like I have it right over here, I'm going to show you that later with the candlestick that I have right behind me, you're going to see how important that is. Basically, Messiah is in the candlestick. He is the servant, and he was the well-lit light that was always supposed to be kept going the whole night until after the great earthquake. After the great earthquake on Passover, it is believed and it's said in the Mishnah and the Talmud that the westernmost light of the menorah, that means the center one, okay, was no longer would go out at night every night. And they saw that was an imminent sign that there was something happening that God was not pleased with them. Because that was the one that had to be lit all night long, all the time. Amen. I'll tell you one thing, that we're covering so much information. It's going to get more interesting because then we're going to start connecting Yom Kippur with Messiah, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Teruah with Messiah. We're going to do all kinds of cool stuff, and I pray that you're enjoying this just as much as I am. You know, being a servant of Yahweh is a privilege and an honor, and it's something that as a servant of the Creator, I delight to for you to understand some of these principles, so when you study Scripture, you understand what it's talking about in the language. You're going to see it all through Scripture. Remember, do not believe anything that I say. Look it all up. We're going to come back right away. We're going to come back to you for the next section about the candlestick, the showbread, the incense, and all the great stories we have for you to tell in regards to the temple service. Yahweh bless you, keep you. Remember, do not believe anything that I say. Go back and look it up. And remember, the temple of Yahweh, where the people, the priestly nation, can come and worship and come near the Creator. Shalom.
If you would like more information about Wisdom and Torah and any other future teachings, please visit www.wisdomintorah.com. Now we leave you with the Aaronic blessing. Shalom.
Yevarechecha Adonai v'yishmerecha Yaeh Adonai Panav Elecha Vichunecha Yisa Adonai Panav Elecha Ve'asem lecha, lecha shalom.
May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make His face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord lift up His countenance upon you and give you shalom. Amen.